mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the CDC last week reported a significant decline in overdose deaths in the past year, with a drop of 35% in Ohio alone. And yet a new study reveals one in four children have at least one parent with a substance use disorder. Also this morning, True to the Code. Co-author McKinley Horton is out with a new book that continues to feed into the public's long-standing curious fascination with mob bosses and the mafia. And with the kids out of school soon and the sometimes chaotic schedule of the summer season, how to simplify and take the stress out of healthy meal planning for the family. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Monday, May 19th, 2025. Apparently, this is news, and I'm not sure why, but it was one of the first things that jumped out at me as I'm perusing the Newswire this morning. You get the latest news and information, the latest headlines to share with you this morning. And this jumped out at me. It's one of the first stories that I saw. I'm not sure why this is news, frankly. Columbus, it says here, is at the top of the list of Ohio cities when it comes to UFO sightings. Now, why is this news? Stacker.com has put together the rankings based on numbers shared by the National UFO Reporting Center. And Columbus, which has had roughly 280 UFO sightings since 1995, lands at number one, well ahead of both Cincinnati and Cleveland. Why is this news? Number one, Columbus is the biggest city in the state of Ohio. So it would logically follow that they would probably have the most UFO sightings. They probably have the most, a lot of things, if you were to rank the things that people do in the state of Ohio. Columbus would probably, it's the biggest city in Ohio. So of course, it is a number one. But for some reason, this is news. It says many Columbus users have contributed descriptions, images, and even some video to the crowdsourced UFO reporting app Enigma. So for some reason, this is news, and now you know. I felt obligated to share it with you this morning because this is news. Speaking of towns, Parade Magazine is out with a list of the 75 funniest town names in the U.S. 75 of the funniest town names in the country. Now, this is not a ranking. They're not saying that this is the funniest town name, this is the second funniest, etc. It's just 75 funny names. You can rank them however you like. But the list begins with Big Bottom, Washington. Big Bottom. How'd you like to live in Big Bottom, Washington? The next stop on the metaphorical road trip of funniest town names in the country, Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. Then there's Dummer, New Hampshire. Dummer, New Hampshire. How would you like to live in Dummer? Hey, I'm a Dummer native. Hohokus, New Jersey. Okay. Those are just a handful. There's also Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, Possum Grape, Arkansas, Horseheads, New York, Dogtown, California, Monkey's Eyebrow, Kentucky, Possum Trot, Alabama, and Hippo, Kentucky. Some of the funniest town names. There are three Ohio towns that made the list. There is Reminderville. Don't want to forget about Reminderville. It is in Summit County near Akron. There is Guysville in Athens County and Crooksville in Perry County, which is known as the Clay City, the former home of Hull Pottery. It's one of the biggest pottery manufacturers historically in the state of Ohio, so Crooksville. So those are the three Ohio cities that made the list. I'm just cracking up thinking about it. 75 funniest town names. All right. Some of those are pretty funny. I don't know about the ones from Ohio that made the list, but there you go. So again, I don't know why that is news, but that is news, and I want to throw it out there because, you know, in the interest of completeness. I do know why this is news. This is news, and I know why. The National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum has now released its Pope Leo XIV bobblehead. You know you've made it when you've got a bobblehead. And the Pope Leo XIV bobblehead is now out. During its release week, 2,000 Pope Leo bobbleheads were sold to customers across 47 states, they say. The museum said the bobbleheads have been popular, particularly in Chicago, where the Pope was born and raised, and in Philadelphia, where the Pope went to college, Villanova. So those are the two hotspots for the Pope bobblehead. The 8-inch bobblehead is now available for pre-sale with an anticipated November shipping date. I don't know why it takes so long to craft the Pope Leo bobbleheads, but apparently they won't be shipping until November. Each of them costs $30 plus tax and shipping. So you can order your Pope Leo the 14th bobblehead. See, some stories you don't know why they make headlines, and then others, you can tell, they're definitely newsworthy. That's definitely a newsworthy item right there, right? This is some interesting research, and I would put this under the category of duh. Researchers from the University of Warwick, which I believe Rhode Island, right? Warwick, Rhode Island? Anyway, researchers in the University of Warwick set out to see why dating app usage appears to have cooled in the past year. There are fewer people on dating apps now than there used to be. And part of this, the researchers discovered, part of this could be due to the frustration that users face trying to establish authentic connections. For example, many apps tend to promote simple engagement metrics like swipes or time spent, you know, looking at someone's profile or something like that. And this is considered a metric of interest, romantic interest by these apps, instead of fostering some method of authentic connection. According to the researchers in the paper, quote, "The industry's future may ultimately depend on whether companies can shift focus from impersonal engagement metrics to fostering authentic connections," unquote. And I'm thinking, wow, that is groundbreaking stuff. Imagine that we need authentic connections to make relationships work instead of just turning over our romantic lives to some random computer app. I'm shocked that we can't just have a computer match us up randomly and that will work. I'm shocked we need authentic connections. Who knew? Man, that's groundbreaking stuff. And lastly here, among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, something to think about as you're rolling out of bed, getting ready for another work week this morning. Is it possible to get too much sleep? Now, we've heard many times in the past several years that Americans, by and large, don't get enough sleep. And it's true. Most of us do not get enough sleep. But is it possible to get too much? A new study from the University of Texas Health Science Center has found that sleeping 9 hours a night could raise your risk of dementia. Researchers followed 1,800 adults, actually a few more than 1,800. I think it was 1,853 adults, all between the ages of 25 and 85, so a wide range of ages. And they found that those who slept more than 9 hours a night performed worse on cognitive tests over time. However, more research, they say, is needed to understand the link between excessive sleep and cognitive decline, as it is possible that early dementia symptoms are leading to increased sleep and not the other way around. Which, I don't know, just at first glance, seems like that might be the more logical conclusion. But regardless, I guess for anything else, if you find yourself getting more and more sleep, like 9 hours or more a night, maybe that is an early warning sign of cognitive decline. I'll tell you what, if that's the threshold, 9 hours of sleep a night, then I must be the smartest guy on the planet. I've not had a risk. If that's your risk factor, I don't have to anything to worry about myself. I don't know about you. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Monday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly sunny today with a high in the middle 60s. Partly cloudy tonight, low around 50. The Ohio Senate has approved a bill that prohibits students from using cell phones during the school day.
The bill prohibits students in kindergarten through 12th grade from using their cell phones during the school day. Republican Senator Jane Timken of Canton said the move fosters a return to face-to-face conversation, better relationships, and improved academic performances. The Dayton Daily News challenges Timken's last statement, saying academic improvement has yet to be seen. If the bill becomes law, all Ohio public schools will have to adopt this policy. Exceptions will be allowed for monitored health conditions.
ONN's Jay Plyburn reporting. Blanchard Valley Health System has announced that it has joined the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center's Heart and Vascular Network. BVHS President and CEO Myron Lewis says they have an opportunity to redefine cardiovascular care in the community through this strategic collaboration. He says the new partnership will help them fulfill their mission of bringing the best health care and highest clinical expertise to those they serve. And the road ahead will focus on expanding cardiovascular services and prioritizing quality care. Get more on BVHS joining the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center's Heart and Vascular Network in this story on our website. Findlay Mayor Christina Murn joined DoorDash and Findlay and Hancock County small business owners at the Findlay-Hancock County Chamber of Commerce to kick off the 2025 DoorDash Accelerator for local businesses. She says the 12-week innovative business development program will combine local resources with DoorDash insights and expertise to help local businesses thrive. The mayor says the city's proud to work with DoorDash to empower local business leaders through mentorship grants and support. 10 entrepreneurs representing a range of small businesses, from restaurants to flower shops, were chosen to participate in the accelerator. See the full list of participating businesses and get more details in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
So now our cover story this morning. This is the very definition of good news, bad news. The CDC last week reported a significant decline in the number of overdose deaths in the past year, with a drop of 35% in Ohio alone. And yet, another new study was published last week, reveals one in four children have at least one parent with a substance use disorder. We are joined this morning by Zach Thomas, his Education and Wellness Director at the Hancock County Board of Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Services. And Zach, first of all, thanks very much for dropping by. And congratulations, by the way, on your honors, state honors being recognized for your advocacy and prevention work and so on. That's got to be really cool.
Well, I appreciate that, Chris. Thank you very much, and good morning.
Yeah. Always got to be nice to be recognized for something that you are passionate about, for your work into something that you are passionate about. So.
Yeah, and quite unexpected. So it was quite an honor.
So this report from the CDC last week, I thought it really jumped out at me. Number one, because the 35% decline year over year in overdose deaths is pretty substantial, but especially when you look at Ohio, and West Virginia was in that group of states that saw a 35% or more decline year over year. And back several years ago, you think 10, 15 years ago, Ohio, West Virginia was kind of the epicenter of the opioid epidemic. So clearly some significant strides being made.
Absolutely. And our overdose rates in Hancock County have reduced significantly. Our highest number was 30 about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And we are now in the single digits.
Wow.
Five and below. So we attribute that to a whole host of things. And, you know, prevention certainly being one of those. Mm-hmm. You know, the expansion of the and the availability of naloxone or Narcan is certainly one of them. But even more importantly is because we've become a recovery-focused community, everyone kind of has this sense of how do we help people achieve recovery and become better. And so the way we've been able to develop our systems and supports to be able to do that has really helped reduce those numbers.
You know, that was the other thing that I thought was significant in exploring this a little bit deeper. Some of the numbers, and these were from Case Western Reserve University, they found a 30% decline, a little bit over 30% decline in the number of Narcan administration instances by first responders. And something close to a 30% decline in the number of hospital visits for overdose, while at the same time, only a 19% increase in the number of Narcan kits that were distributed to the public. So if you look at those numbers, it seems to suggest that it's not just fewer overdose deaths, but fewer overdoses, period.
Yeah, I agree. And also the fact that we have a lot of people that are in the community that are doing the outreach and getting connected with folks that they know are in active use as ways to get them engaged in support, treatment, whatever, as a way to prevent future overdoses from happening.
And you talk about the community-wide effort to talk about prevention and recovery. What are the components of that? I mean, explain what that means.
Yeah, so two kind of big buckets I'll focus on. One is our harm reduction program, SafeWorks, which has opportunities for people that are in active use to be able to get connected with someone that has lived experience or be able to get them those accesses to Narcan, to safer supplies, those types of things. Mm-hmm. And also, there are kind of road crew people that are out going to folks where they are, where they know that they might be living or on the streets and trying to intervene that way. And that's kind of our harm reduction program that we build up very robustly across the community. Mm-hmm. On the prevention side, thinking much younger, we try to think about, you know, how do we build those connections with youth? How do we get them to advocate for themselves and think about where to turn in times of need? And also helping us understand more about just adolescent and brain development. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things that we need to know to intervene appropriately so that we help them make better choices, how we help them when the times of struggle. And so we're looking at those, both ends of the spectrum when it comes to preventing overdose fatalities and overdoses in general in our community.
Do you still fight the battle to a certain extent? Because I know when Narcan was introduced, when the naloxone was introduced, there was some pushback with the idea of this is going to encourage people to use it. It's going to remove one of the consequences, the biggest consequence of drug use that might keep people from using and make it more accessible. And similarly, the idea of providing quote-unquote safer supply, that it was removing the stigma from it. Do you still fight that mindset?
Well, certainly not to the extent that we did when these concepts and programs were first introduced. And I think partly it's because we've been able to really educate and provide awareness of, you know, you certainly can't support someone that has passed from an overdose.
Right.
And so this isn't certainly where we want them to be the rest of their lives, but it is a step closer. And every time we have a touch point, every time we have an opportunity to intervene, is one step closer to them achieving recovery.
It's interesting you talk about intervening at the earliest ages with respect to children and prevention efforts, because obviously the easiest way to prevent overdose and overdose deaths is to make sure that young people never start. And that kind of leads to, as we mentioned, the bad news side of the reports that were out last week. And this was a study in JAMA Pediatrics that 1 in 4 children have a parent with a substance use disorder. Now, the vast majority of that is alcohol, but at the same time, 1 in 4, that is beyond surprising. That's alarming. I mean, that really...
I would agree. And, you know, hereditary heredity is the number one predictor of future substance use. And but the knowing that 25% have a parent or a loved one with the lived experience helps us think about how do we approach our youth. And because of that, one of the things that we do to help our youth that have an experience like that with a loved one or parent is, you know, we provide a camp fund, which happens twice a year. So kids that have an experience with a parent member with addiction, it's a way for them to get together. And we're not necessarily reinforcing the fact of what's in their life that's a struggle, but just a way to connect, a way to feel belonged, and a way for them to just kind of have a fun day where they don't necessarily have to worry about the strifes at home.
Mm-hmm. I don't know from that study. I didn't read enough of that study to know how many of those children may or may not have contact with that parent who has a substance use disorder. So I'm guessing that there may be a few, more than a few, that don't have contact with that particular parent for one reason or another. But I wonder, does that make it easier or harder to deliver that message of prevention? Because I think there's one, I would imagine there are one or two ways that could go, that a young person will see the impact of that and say, I don't want that to happen to me, or they will see that and just feel that that is normal.
Well, that's a great question and difficult to answer, I think, in a way, because, you know, when we approach kids that are experiencing that, you're right, Chris. They could be experiencing it two different ways that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But our approach to providing opportunities for connection with those kids doesn't change, regardless mm-hmm. of how they view it, which I think is more important and most important, is that they know that they have someone that cares about them.
Yeah. And it certainly underscores the challenge that lies in reaching that next generation when so many kids are exposed to it.
Yeah. Again, you know, the more opportunities there are for them to be connected to something outside of their immediate experience is really, really powerful.
And, you know, you talk about some of the resources that we have within the community to reach those kids. Would it be fair to say that this is something that falls on all of us to be cognizant of the challenges that so many of these kids face?
Yeah. You know, actually, one of the things that our Coalition on Addiction is working on is expanding the message of we all can help someone.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have a capacity to be able to do that, whatever it is for ourselves, for that other person, whether it's taking them out to get a coffee, whether it's helping them, you know, with a kid, you know, take them to school, that we all have the capacity to recognize that someone's going through something mm-hmm. and we all can do something to help make their life a little bit better.
Yeah. Cause I'm thinking, I mean, most of us will probably come into contact with some of these kids, either, you know, they're friends of our kids or classmates or, you know, what have you. We will probably encounter these. We can all play a small part of that, right?
Yeah, and even more importantly, I think we may not even know
yeah.
that they're going through that. And so showing the kindness and the care and concern could be that light in their life that we never knew that made the difference for their day.
Yeah. Bottom line is that you see some of those numbers about the decline in overdose deaths. You want to jump for joy, but obviously this other report, as we mentioned, demonstrates that there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, I agree. We take, you know, kind of the good with the difficult
mm-hmm. yeah.
and try to do everything we can to keep moving forward.
Yeah. So we have to ask, obviously, there are a lot of resources and we are blessed in this community to have a number of resources for those who either are struggling or know someone who is struggling or have that thought that maybe, again, a young person is struggling with some of these circumstances. Where do we start in reaching out?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One is certainly Hancock Helps is, you know, our local website where people can find a whole listing of how to get connected to a support group, to services, to treatment, and so forth. I would also say, and, you know, given that our mental health challenges are increasing, particularly among our youth, 988, which is our crisis line, which can get people connected directly to support, is really important for everyone to kind of keep that at their fingertips, that And if it's a crisis or not, you can call that number and they can help guide you.
And as we've mentioned before, as sort of a postscript on all of this, the issues of mental health and addiction quite often go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Yeah, they do. It's hard. Sometimes one comes first and the other one follows and vice versa, but it's important to keep them all together and think about how we can support in that way.
Again, the good news is progress is being made, but obviously still much more work to be done. Zach Thomas is Education and Wellness Director of the Hancock County Board of Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Services. Zach, thanks very much for dropping by.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, you know, Americans have long had a curious fascination with the mafia and the life of mob bosses who rule the underworld. Certainly no doubt that many have indeed left their mark on American history. And veteran true crime journalist McKinley Horton is co-author of a new book profiling one such figure. True to the Code focuses on the rise and fall of notorious Philadelphia gangster Nicodemo Scarfo, a.k.a. Little Nicky. McKinley, thanks for taking the time this morning. First of all, let's start at the beginning. Who is Little Nicky and why was it important for you to tell his story?
Well, Chris, thank you so much for having me. Get to the point of why, because Philadelphia was always known as a city of brotherly love. Well, Mr. Scarfo turned it into a city of blood and love. And the point was that someone had to be able to control the city of Philadelphia from New York. And Nicodemus Scarfo was chosen from Angelo Bruno, who also was a capo of Philadelphia, who did things a little differently. But Nicodemus Scarfo began to do it in a different way. Some would say more like the La Cosa Nostra of old.
This was an offshoot of the New York Mafia. I mean, when we think of the Mafia, we think of New York, Chicago, Vegas, of course, and its mob connections. Philadelphia is not necessarily one of the cities that we immediately think of.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. Atlantic City was always in the middle of New York and Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a prime oyster for any crime boss or any family. And who would control South Jersey? Who would control the in-betweens between Philadelphia and New York? Well, it was the Philadelphia family, the Genovese family, which was also given to reins to Philadelphia and Angelo Bruno, and to be able to run the number rackets, prostitution, and every other racket that could be underneath the reign.
Yeah.
Nicky was just a Formula One position. He believed that he could be a boss of the whole world. You know, if you go back to the movie Scarface, you know, he said, Manny, I want the world and everything in it. Well, Nicky believed in that.
Hmm. So where does that put him in sort of the, I don't want to say the hierarchy or the, I mean, was he kind of cut from the same mold as, say, an Al Capone or a John Gotti, or is he more of a precursor to kind of the new breed of mob boss that we have today?
Well, it's interesting you say that, too. In the early days in the 40s, Lucky Luciano, who started the commission, was given the power to run, you know, basically what you know as the mafia today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he would be more of a soldier of that time.
Okay.
To be in control of the racketeering and to keep the rules of the old and keeping it new so no one would ever, ever forget it. Nicky believed in one thing, true to the code.
So I was going to ask you about that, the title of the book, True to the Code. What does that mean? And why was that so significant in the case of Little Nicky?
Well, if we go back to the hits and the betrayals and the power plays and the blood oaths of the Philly mob, you might understand that Nicky Scarfo believed in the idea of loyalty. If he was not loyal to the ring, if he was not loyal to the faction of the mafia, you would have a problem with Nicky, because the New York families loved that about him. Sammy the Bull, John Gotti, they all loved him. They loved him because he was never a rat. He never would go behind someone's back to tell on someone. This was the opposite. He would be the one that would be ratted on. He would be the one, his own nephew, Phil Leonetti, told on him. Nicky Carabondi, toll on him because they was all scared of him. But really, it was a part of the faction from New York to keep true to the code and never ever break the loyalty of it all.
Why is it that the public seems to have such an incredible fascination with these figures of the underworld, the mafia, the mob bosses, the soldiers in the mob families? What is it that loyalty that draws us to the, I mean, I'm just curious. These are not good guys, and yet we are so drawn to them.
Well, I think it's the American dream. If you really think about it, the people that chase the American dream chase it in different ways. If you're in athletics, you know, you want to be the best like Jordan or LeBron or Kobe. If you're in politics, you want to be the best, whoever your favorite politician. Well, Nicky was, he wanted to be a gangster. He wanted to run and rule the mafia with an iron fist. He wanted to make sure that people don't forget him and never forget the rules of what the mafia meant. He believed in codes. He believed in honor. He believed in trust. And the little people that you call little people in the world, that he never looked upon them. He defended them. So he did some good, too, for the people that had no chance to making it. If it came down to someone trying to make it in real life, he could help them. Just like if you look in The Godfather opens up with The Undertaker asking that someone had hurt his daughter. Vito Corleone said, hey, I'm going to help you. Well, Nicky kind of like was like that, too. He made that old school mafioso stay alive.
That certainly, I think, probably plays into it as well, because these are complex characters, and I would imagine that's one of the things that makes them fun to write about.
Oh, without a question. If you think about the Italian Americans, Black Americans, Jewish, Irish, all of them, all people in America have had a mafia. And there's always somebody they could go to protect the neighborhood. Think about it. The neighborhood, your neighborhood was protected by a guy that made sure nobody would rob your grandmother, nobody would hurt your aunt, nobody would even dare to like lay some street code on the family members in the neighborhood. They protected the neighborhood of Philadelphia.
And yet it's interesting, as sort of emotionally invested as we become in these complex characters, again, with plenty of non-redeeming qualities, we tend to get wrapped up in these emotional stories, knowing that more than likely they are going to end in a violent way.
Yeah, that I'm not trying to glorify it. I'm just trying to give the human life to it.
Yeah.
If you really think about it, it's more different than just glorifying. It's fascinating to see what they're willing to risk. Nicky died in jail. He died in jail. He knew that the demise of him was going to come by the way he lived, but he believed in it. And you know, when you believe in something, you die for something. And that's what True to the Code really truly means.
Yeah. Again, McKinley Horton is a veteran true crime journalist, co-author of the new book, True to the Code, Nicodemo Scarfo, The Story of Little Nicky. Where do folks get their hands on the book?
Barnes & Noble online, Amazon.com. Other bookstores will be carrying it soon. We're going to be taking it also into a stage play in New York and also into a film. We're looking at Johnny Depp playing Nicodemo Scarfo. We've been in contact with his people, so we think we can make a great story come out of a sad story, too, at the same time.
Fascinating stuff. McKinley Horton, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
And thank you so much.
You're listening to Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
We've been on a roll here lately. Here's another story fairly close to home that is worthy of the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines. A woman who reportedly tried to flee last week from Toledo Municipal Court is scheduled to appear before a judge today. 33-year-old Kara Rose was in court on Thursday answering to multiple charges, including theft and failure to stop after an accident, when prosecutors say she ran from the courtroom. She made it as far as the judge's parking area outside the building in the parking lot when she was tased and rearrested. And then she was, and first of all, I thought to myself, who couldn't see this coming? I mean, her charges included failure to stop after an accident. So she ran from the accident. Who couldn't have seen that coming, that she would run from the courtroom? It just seemed, it was kind of par for the course. So anyway, then Ms. Rose was supposed to be in court on Friday on new charges related to the escape attempt, but refused to appear. Again, who couldn't see that coming? It seems like her MO there. She is scheduled to be in court today. We'll see if that actually happens. Elsewhere in the broken news this morning, not to be outdone, a 32-year-old woman in Ocala, Florida was arrested after allegedly refusing to pay her tab at a steakhouse and punching a responding police officer in the private parts. She punched a cop in the place where you don't want to be punched. The incident occurred earlier this month when the Ocala Police Department responded to a call regarding a woman who would not pay her bill. Mark's Prime Steakhouse claimed that the woman owed nearly $100. When an officer attempted to escort the suspect out of the restaurant, she reportedly became agitated and punched the officer with her fist in his, you know. Spoiler alert, that did not make the situation better. She did not improve her situation by doing so. She has now been charged with battery on a law enforcement officer and swindling an innkeeper, which has to be the coolest sounding charge ever. I mean, just not robbery, you know, running out on your bill. How do we make that sound official? Swindling an innkeeper. It's the charge. Let's see. If I was ever going to be charged with something, I want it to be something cool sounding, like swindling an innkeeper. Let's see here. A Utah man. Now, this is unusual. A man in Utah is facing charges after allegedly holding a group of people hostage for 6 months at a home in Mill Creek. Now, this is the story, and it doesn't sound like this would be something to chuckle about, but 23-year-old Dominic Christopher Garcia convinced his live-in girlfriend and her family that they were targets of a cartel and made threats to prevent them from leaving. He said, if you leave, the cartel is going to find you, and they're going to wipe you out. They're living in Utah. I mean, all of the places that the cartel would probably not be in Utah. Anyway, he later admitted the story was entirely fabricated, saying he continued to lie out of fear of rejection. Yeah, that'll work. That'll work. He is facing 28 criminal charges and is currently jailed without bail. Alrighty, a couple of other items here. The broken news. In downtown Nashville, a shirtless, shoeless man is facing charges after allegedly stealing a party bus on Thursday and crashing it into multiple cars. A shirtless, shoeless man allegedly stole a party bus and crashed it into multiple cars. Happened this past Thursday. Police say the suspect reportedly jumped onto the Nashville dive bar shuttle while the driver was escorting the passengers into a bar. He then took off on the party bus, striking at least three vehicles before abandoning the bus. No injuries were reported. Police are still looking for the suspect. It is possible to have too much fun in downtown Nashville. It's a fun place to be. You can have too much fun. Demonstrated there. Let's see. And a couple of other items here. In the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines, everyone wants a special name for their baby. But one Alabama family has apparently gone too far. A new mom claims that the hospital in Alabama, and I'm not sure the name of the hospital or exactly where it's at in Alabama, but she claims that the hospital would not let her put her chosen name on her baby's birth certificate. They would not put the chosen name that she had picked out for her little bundle of joy on the birth certificate. And apparently she's now going to have to go to court to settle the issue. The mom said in a social media post, "We picked out a unique name that means a lot to us. Zerfgolsky. Zerfgolsky. It is spelled, are you ready for this? X-F-R-G-O-L-S-Z-Z-Z-X-Y. Pronounced Zerfgolsky. I know it's different, said the mom, and that's the whole point. Maybe that's a little too different. A hospital worker claimed that names with X followed by a consonant are not allowed. And that's why the system wouldn't let them, the computer system wouldn't let them enter that as the, so just add a vowel. How would you like to go through life with a name like Zerfgolsky? Man. X-F-R-G-O-L-S-Z-Z-Z-X-Y. Little too different. The people of Alabama, apparently. And finally, in the broken news this morning, a scuba diver in Florida has a big fish story to tell. Christina Scott says she found a 6-inch tooth from an extinct megalodon shark while diving off the coast of Venice recently. 6-inch tooth from the megalodon shark, which has been extinct for more than 3 million years. Megalodons died out more than 3 million years ago. They were 60 feet long and had nearly 300 teeth. Those fossilized teeth are the only thing that has survived, that is known to have survived anywhere in the world. How cool is that, though, to find a 6-inch megalodon shark tooth? If you're going to have a shark encounter while scuba diving in Florida, that's the kind you want to have. That's the only kind of shark encounter that you want to have. You know what I mean? There you go. That is today's broken news, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
The Hancock Sports Hall of Fame golf outing is Friday, June 27th at Hillcrest Golf Club in Findlay. Register at HancockHOF.com under the events tab. Registration fee is $300 per team or $75 per person. Proceeds from the outing benefit the Hancock Sports Hall of Fame, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The Hancock Sports Hall of Fame golf outing, Friday, June 27th at Hillcrest. Register at HancockHOF.com. This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. You ever heard that saying? I see it on t-shirts and internet memes and things like that. The more people I meet, the more I like my dog. Well, apparently it is true. A new survey of 1,900 dog owners found that 63% of Gen Zers who own dogs will dine with their dogs. We all eat together. 69% of millennials watch TV with their dogs. 55% of all pet parents let their dogs sleep in the bed. We don't do that in our house. 52% say their dog's health is as important as their own. And 41% say their dog's health is actually more important than their own. And on top of that, 74%, if they could, 74% of Gen Zers say that they would have their dog cloned. The CEO of Spot and Tango, which is a manufacturer of gourmet dog food, says it is clear from this survey that for many, investing in a dog's health and longevity isn't just a priority. It's a reflection of how we define family and our own quality of life. wrap up the program with this. Do you ever have one of those days, one of those weeks where you are too tired to cook, too busy to meal plan, and takeout ends up being the easiest option? Yeah, we have all been there. I mean, today is a Monday. Maybe today will be one of those days, maybe be one of those weeks. Too soon to tell, but you know. And especially now that we're coming up on the summer season, the kids out of school very soon. And sometimes, you know how during the summer schedules get kind of chaotic and all of that. The problem is, while just go and takeout may be the solution of least resistance, it is certainly not the most nutritionally sound solution. No surprise there. So joining us this morning to share some simple and sustainable strategies to help take some of the pressure and stress off of meal planning is the head of nutrition at MyFitnessPal, Melissa Yeager, with us once again. And Melissa, you know the struggle, right? I mean, please tell us we are not alone in this.
You are not alone. Meal planning is ultimately a habit, and new habits just take time to build, right? And like you said, between things like busy schedules and trying to find the right recipes that everyone will love in your household, meal planning can start to feel a little bit like a chore and less like that path to achieving your health goals.
So you talk about that link between cooking at home and better nutrition. Again, it's not a surprise. We've heard this before, but talk a little bit about the ripple effect that this can have on our overall health.
Meal planning is really answering that question of what's for dinner tonight ahead of time. So it's helping to take some of that stress around meal times and deciding what to eat for dinner tonight off your plate because you've already done in advance. And ultimately, when you're meal prepping at home, not only can you you're using, but you can also control the portion size that you're served. So it makes it a little bit easier to factor in all those nutrient-dense foods like fruits, veggies, whole grains, lean sources of protein, all while supporting your weight management goals.
So you're going to tell us this morning about some of the tools and resources that you have to make meal planning less stressful.
Exactly. I think having the right tools in place is so key for helping to build this habit. And ultimately, I encourage you to maybe set aside that pen and paper and stop scouring the internet for new recipes and instead check out MyFitnessPal's new planner. What I love is that it's going to create a customized weekly meal plan that meets not only your health goals, but your budget goals. And all you need to do, simply provide a little bit of information, things like what is your budget? What are your food likes or dislikes? What is your household size? Any dietary preferences you might have? And in return, get that personalized weekly meal plan that includes not only the recipes, but also that ever grocery shopping list. But if you don't feel like heading into the grocery store, there's a solution for that too. You can have the groceries from your MyFitnessPal meal plan delivered straight to your door with major e-retailers like Instacart.
So there you go. Maybe it's not so much that someone is too busy to properly meal plan. Maybe it's someone who's never really done it before. You were kind of alluding to this earlier. Maybe somebody hasn't given it much thought beyond just one day to the next. What are some realistic ways that you can recommend for someone who is brand new to the concept of meal planning and doesn't really maybe know where to start?
Exactly. Sometimes getting started is the hardest part when forming a new habit. And I think we're in the perfect season to get started with meal planning simply by doing a little spring cleaning on our fridge, pantry, or freezer. Go through, find out what you already have on hand, maybe throw out any of those expired products that you can start fresh and restock some of those key staples, things like cooking oils, spices and herbs, dried goods like rice or pasta that you know are going to be incorporated into the meals you love to eat and are easy to keep on hand so that when it comes time to build that grocery shopping list, you're avoiding purchasing any duplicates and ultimately saving yourself a little bit of money.
You know, one of the other things that strikes me that this is like many other things we'll talk about when we talk about, improving our health, whether it's a diet or an exercise plan or really anything, you're still going to have those days where you're going to be too busy to cook, or there's something comes up at the last minute, and don't feel guilty if you quote unquote fall off the wagon or have to put this on hold every now and then, right?
Exactly. It's all about finding that balance in your routine and finding the right time to shop, to prepare, all of those things, because ultimately, if we're not finding the time in our schedules in advance, it can be really hard to motivate ourselves to simply get started. So take your time each week. Take a look at the schedule, the family schedule. If you are traveling or you know it's just not real or you have plans to go out to eat, enjoy those opportunities and factor in meal planning where you can.
Yeah. Again, Melissa Yeager is the head of nutrition at MyFitnessPal, talking about ways of getting started with true meal planning, not just coming home after work and saying, okay, what are we having for dinner tonight? That's not really a plan. Where do folks learn more, Melissa?
To try out our new meal planner feature, I encourage you to head to the Apple App Store or Google Play Store and download MyFitnessPal today, and you can unlock that meal planner feature with a Premium Plus subscription.
Melissa, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Go to goodmornings.net. You can also connect with us on social media, sign up for our daily email newsletter, and more. And if you are a fan of the show, we ask that you please leave us a rating, a review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the program as well. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.